high if you have a winning shot in front of 20,000 people and the game is over. And, you know, that you can't duplicate that in business life. I don't know if you get that excited by closing a deal. You got to check yourself a little bit when your sports career is over and figure out what really motivates you. I take a lot of pleasure in being able to help people or being able to guide someone in the right direction or mentoring somebody. It's obviously not the same adrenaline, but it's definitely longer lasting when you see the impact you have.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. My guest on this episode is NBA legend Detlef Schrempf. He played 16 years in the league and over 1,000 games, was a three-time All-Star and two-time Olympian. He was part of those amazing Sonics teams in the 90s that won over 60 games, 5 years in a row, won the Western Conference, and went to the finals. And he's remained active in business, giving back to the community, starting foundations, and doing all kinds of things since leaving basketball. He talked about lessons from his basketball career, getting into business, reading, philanthropy, and the common sense principles that have guided him in life after sports. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Detlef Schrempf. Hey, Detlef, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Adam. Appreciate it.
Really excited about this. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. I wanted to start by asking you, when I was doing a little background on you, I heard that when you were playing college basketball way back at UW, they were locking you out of local gyms. What's the story behind that?
I would probably say I went a little overboard. I still have a great passion for the game. I think basketball is the best game there is. And I was just hooked once I had some success as a teenager. I finally found something I was good at. I was totally hooked. And when I got to the college level, there were so many opportunities to play basketball. And you're so restricted by the NCAA, how long you can practice and all those things. And you only had the gym for a little bit. So I play pickup ball all the time. And unfortunately, I limped into a couple practices where I sprained my ankle. And you know, my coach is like, "You stupid, you're an All-American, you can't do this anymore." So there was this talk that they tried to ban me from the IMA building, and then I found other places to play. So he eventually gave up.
He gave up? So you kept doing that throughout your college?
Yeah, pretty much. In my senior year, I sprained my ankle really bad in a national televised game, and that basically was where I was out for quite a bit. I kept playing games, but I couldn't practice much. But until then, I was playing everywhere all the time.
What was it that gave you such a deep motivation and love for the game?
First of all, I think it's just it's a great game because every play is different. Every move is different. Every shot is different. It's very competitive, and it's something you can't play for the rest of your life, but you have that kind of window of opportunity where you're in good health and athletic and do all those things. And at the same time, I think it gave me a feeling of success as this teenager that had all kinds of issues, struggled to fit in, and it's very awkward. And all of a sudden, I found a game where, hey, you know, I'm pretty good at this. And I just rose to the top so quickly. That gives you a lot of confidence. It gives you something, you know, to take pride in. And I think that just stuck with me for a long time.
That's awesome. Can you talk about how that rise happened? Like, how quick was it? Was it immediately when you stopped playing soccer and started playing basketball? You said, "Hey, I'm good at this." Or how quickly did that kind of lock into gear for you?
Yeah, I mean, I started basketball pretty late. I was like, you know, every German kid played soccer growing up. And at 13, I wasn't enjoying the team I'm on, the club I'm on, and didn't really fit in there, and just had to stumble across basketball. Went to basketball in a PE class. And my coach, PE teacher at the time, to UCLA, played basketball and played basketball in Germany, and he introduced basketball to me. And I literally joined with another guy that I played soccer with, a club, and I started on the third team in my, you know, 14-year-old division. And within half the season, I was, playing for the first team and starting. And then by literally when I was 16, I was playing on three teams. I was playing on my team, the age group above me, and a man's team in the third division. So I was just, I went a little overboard, but again, it worked out for me.
As you've gone into other endeavors, do you still go deep and go a little overboard when you start a new project or these other turns in your career post-basketball?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think with age comes a little wisdom. I'm not claiming I have a lot of it, but obviously I've slowed down a little bit also physically, mentally, but also that drive, I don't know if it's drive or that addiction is not there. I used to be, even starting this job, I wouldn't let it go unless I finished something, whether it was a presentation or trying to figure out a pitch or trying to get in touch with someone. It was just nonstop. And you learn that it's not all about that. I enjoy the challenge. I enjoy being active. I enjoy working. But the only time I got left is time. Basically, all I got left is time. And it's very precious. And so I've gotten a lot more sensitive to that issue of being ADD about something and not stopping.
Yeah. How do you become aware of that now when you're starting to go deep or obsessed with the next thing? Do you have little mental tricks or checks that you do? Or how do you balance that out as you've gotten older and gotten some of that wisdom?
Yeah, I still do some of it where I take on a project. I don't want to get to it. I want to have a plan for it. And I want to have a process in place and move forward. I don't want it to be stagnant, right? But I take on fewer. And for me, there's not the incentive. I think when you're young, you have the stage of, I got to succeed. You know, and for all of us, I think for most people, we go through the stage, at least my generation was, I got to do well. I got to make money. I got to make more money. I got to get a house. I got to get a bigger house. I got to get a bigger car. I got to get a better job. Everyone goes through that phase. Again, I'm just talking more about my generation, probably my parents' generation. I think the younger generation is not quite, I wouldn't say driven. They're not that preoccupied about showing what they have and how much success they have. They got to have. But when you get older, you go, you know, I'm not monetarily driven anymore. I don't need to make money. I enjoy working. I enjoy working with people that I want to be around. I want to provide value, you know, where I can provide some solutions and some direction, maybe help on different fronts, either with children or charitable stuff. I want to provide value and have other people succeed. It's not about, I got to close this deal so I make more money, because it's just not relevant anymore. We live a pretty good life. There's no scaling in my life anymore. I don't need to scale. I don't need to get a bigger house. I don't need to get a bigger car or all those things. They're not on the plate. I really not a concern to me.
I love that. I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the great Sonics teams you were on in the 90s. I'm sure a lot of people ask you this, but I think was it 5 years of averaging 60 plus wins? Did I have that research right?
Yeah, I think we averaged over 60 wins for 5 years, and then our last year was the lockout year, so I think we only played 50 games, I want to say. But for those 6 years, yeah, we averaged over 60 wins, and it was a great time. It's a great time to be a Sonics fan.
It was. I was in there in Key Arena many nights, and they were fun teams. You always seemed to, the whole team looked very competitive, but like everybody was having fun out there as well. What was the culture like of that team behind the scenes?
Oh, it was a little crazy. I think we all got along well. We had some issues the first year where some guys didn't get along well, and I think that showed in, you know, losing the first round playoffs, and they made some changes. But overall, we had a pretty good time. It was very competitive. We had a lot of veterans, so there was a lot of needling each other because we had different personalities. There was a lot of going at each other. Practices were oftentimes harder than games, and we had disagreements, but as soon as we stepped on the court, we all knew we were about winning, and we all played hurt and we played sick, and because everyone was about winning. It was fun because we stepped on the court, and oftentimes you saw the other team, especially against average teams, they were scared to play us. So it was a fun time.
What were some of the traits of the culture, or maybe principles or behaviors in those 90s Sonics teams that stood out from some of the other teams you were part of?
Yeah, I think the culture, the competitive culture we had, I was on teams that were pretty good as a team and togetherness, and others that weren't. That team had like pockets where 3-4 guys would hang out, and then there'd be an overlap of 3-4 guys, and then there'd be another overlap. So you got to spend time with guys, and some went out at night, and to some of us that was just not appealing, especially when you get a little older. But every once in a while, he gave in. He said, okay, the whole team is going out tonight. Eight guys would be going out to some club. And not that we were partying hard, but we were doing those things. So we'd go to a movie together. So it was a pretty good culture. And it was from a competitive standpoint. There was a lot of talking in practice, a lot of trash talking. And so it was pretty competitive. And as far as playing together defensively, we played differently than anybody else. You had to almost something like a little bit. When you see teams now that switch everything, we had to switch everything. You had to be able to guard a point guard to a center. And if you didn't, you had to rely on your teammates to make sure they're going to be there helping. And you had to force the ball in a certain way. And if the help wasn't there, it wasn't on you. It was on the help side. So we really relied on each other defensively and bailed each other out. And it was a fun way because when you then get that turnover, missed shot, and you're going the other way, you get rewarded for it.
Yeah, I remember the defensive scheme, if I remember, it was pretty unconventional at those times with the trapping and switching. And was that hard to get implemented? Like, were people supportive of the strategy, or what did it look like behind the scenes coming together to play that way when not everybody else in the league at that time was doing it?
Well, you had to put your ego in check because of I remember, first of all, you had to be in good shape because there was a lot of trapping and rotating. And we took teams, for example, say Utah Jazz, where it was Stockton Malone. 80% of the time, they were involved in every play. What our concept was, we're going to make other guys beat us. So we're going to take the ball out of their hands. So literally against Stockton Malone, every time down the court, I ran over and double-teamed John Stockton. So he would have to pass the ball. And then I had to run back out and rotate. And you do that, you know, for 40 out of 48 minutes. So same with other guys where they were great one-on-one players like a Michael Jordan and be isolated on a wing and we run somebody at it and make somebody else make a play. And that was different than what most teams played.
It sounds like you needed everybody to really buy into it as well, to be willing to run around and put their ego aside and play the team D.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it was pretty obvious. And because we were rotating so much, when you're watching films and somebody didn't do their job, because you can end up in an embarrassing moment because you're pushing the ball one side for your helper to be there so you can trap it, and the guy didn't show up, and someone would go in for an uncontested layup or dunk. And so we made sure everyone was aware of the way we were playing.
Now, Gary Payton was obviously a legendary kind of talker on the court. Was he quiet and calm in practice, or was there a lot of kind of going at it? Even you mentioned practices were almost as hard as the games. Was that just his standard state, or is it different in practice?
You know, Gary didn't enjoy practice, and so he'd sit on the sideline and commentate. As veterans, we would just tell him to shut up because if you're not practicing, you can't make any comments. And then he typically would get tired halfway through and put on the shoes and come out and scrimmage. Again, the veteran team encouraging each other to play and practice.
What was it like playing in Key Arena in those days? I remember just being a loud, kind of wild place where opposing teams didn't want to come in there. How much did that environment play into the ethos of the team and the feeling that it was being part of that?
Oh, it was great. Key Arena was always packed, sold out for those 5 years of that stretch for sure. And it was the loudest arena in the NBA back then. When the fans got behind you, it was incredible. We had just a great fan base. And we had that sixth man that somewhat turned into the Seahawks' 12th man. When you talk about home court advantage, it's huge when can create that noise and really elevate you.
Yeah. Has there ever been anything in your business career that's comparable to that kind of feeling?
No, you can't get the highs and lows you get from playing pro sports. And I appreciate both of them because we can't really appreciate the highs without living the lows, and every athlete had enough lows. A high if you have a winning shot in front of 20,000 people, and the game is over, and you know that you can't duplicate that in kind of business life. I don't know if you get that excited by closing a deal. You got to check yourself a little bit when your sports career is over and figure out what really motivates you and I take a lot of pleasure in being able to help people or being able to guide someone in the right direction or mentoring somebody. And it's obviously not the same adrenaline, but it's definitely longer lasting when you see the impact you have.
Mm-hmm. What's the other side of that? If the high is 20,000 screaming fans when you hit the game winner, what were some of the low points when, you know, in playing professional sports that you mentioned to balance it out?
Well, obvious ones are injury. If you play long enough, you're going to get hurt. And it's how you come back from that. Is it serious? Can you come back and be the same player? I think most players have to go through that. Then it's everyone goes through bad stretches. And it could be that you're a good free throw shooter in 3-4 games. You can't buy a free throw. I think every player has gone through that where you have a stretch where, you know, it's like an 80% free throw shooter, but all of a sudden I have 3-4 games where I'm shooting 50%. And it could have been you hit your elbow on the floor and it doesn't feel right. There are a lot of excuses. And it's those kind of stretches. Or you have 2-3 games. Everyone has bad games, but you have a stretch of bad games. The self-doubt creeps in of, hey, what am I doing wrong? What's going on? And I think early in my career where you're an All-American, get in the pros, and then you're not playing as much as you hope. You self-doubt yourself about, am I good enough? You know, can I be an All-Star, or am I just a bench warmer? And you do all those things to try and get to that point, but doubt definitely creeps in.
What were some of the things you would do to get past that self-doubt? And you have had a long career, 16 years successful. I imagine there were a lot of those lower moments. What were some of your tools to get past it?
It took me a while because at the beginning I just worked more. In Dallas, I just practiced more. After practice, I shot. I was the only one that was lifting weights, which is unbelievable coming from a college program that had a strength training process and we were in the strength, in the fitness center working out. And I went to a pro team that didn't even have a weight room. So it was like, okay, I joined a club and was there working out all the time and I'm playing there on the side and open gym. And I was practicing a lot, but I was in those first 2 years, it wasn't really improving. So and I ran into a guy who was like a sports psychologist and he's like, hey, what are you doing to better yourself? I said, you see me every day. I'm killing myself over here. I'm lifting weights. I'm working out. Shuts up. I'm doing all this stuff to get better. And he was like, what are you doing mentally? I go, what do you mean? I had no, back then nobody talked about it. And I kind of got into a self-affirmation a little bit. And it was just very simple stuff. You're just telling yourself that you're good enough. And that these phrases I repeated over and over. And I believe that helped. But at the same time, I started playing more. And obviously, my career took off after that. But it was more about believing in yourself and coming up with a way to instill that self-confidence that when you have doubt and when the media is on you and whatever else. And nowadays, when the social media is on you, and those guys read everything, it's a bad thing.
It's a lot now. You almost can't escape it these days with all the channels and all the commentary, and everybody's got an opinion to share.
Yeah, for sure.
You were present in philanthropy. You ran a foundation for 25 years, I think, and you started that back in your playing career. Was it common at that time for professional athletes to start foundations and get involved in philanthropy in that way, or was that somewhat unconventional?
Yeah, it wasn't really that common to start a foundation. And back then, I was probably young and dumb. I didn't really have much of an idea what it took. But we started a camp back in Indiana, actually, when I was there. That was called Winning at Life. And it was, obviously teaching basketball, but it's more about succeeding in school and taking care of opportunities and exploring those. Then when I got traded to Seattle, we were like, okay, let's figure out how we can give back to the community. And then this is the early 90s, I think, And the big thing at that time was celebrity golf tournaments. That's when they started. First thing I did was a celebrity golf tournament with a local radio station. It was a sports radio station in KJR. And then it just took off because everyone wanted a piece. They wanted me to do this. They wanted an appearance. They wanted me to chair this. And it was where we couldn't really manage it. So we formed our foundation. I hired a staff and basically took off from there for 25 years. And our focus was children and families in need because we had small children and we want to make sure that other families had the services they needed. And we did that for 25 years. And it's like you ask the same people, all your friends, to donate and gift every year. So we got to that point where we aged out. My executive director aged out. Everyone's dealing with health issues. And we said, okay, 25 years is good. Let's move on. And we did. And then I'm just trying to focus on some other things.
That's incredible. What motivated you to get involved in that way? Even as you said, you were pretty young at the time and already starting to think about giving back. What was behind that?
Like I said earlier, we're so worried about scaling and making more money for ourselves and finding our place. Eventually, got to figure out what's important. And with us, it's about family. I want my kids to have a happy life and not be a burden on other people, but also be, you know, compassionate and help other people. And for us, it was an easy choice. We wanted to make sure we can give back because we're blessed. We were very fortunate that we can give back to other families that had children also. That's how we got started.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, we were talking about the highs and the lows of playing professional basketball and how those don't exist so much in going to business and, you know, other areas of life. And you said that you had to look at what your strengths were and what you wanted to do. What did that transition process look like, you know, after the MBA? What were some of the questions you were asking yourself?
That's a good question because I did not know what I was going to do after basketball. I mean, I got involved at the end of my career with trying to figure it out. I joined a couple advisory boards for real estate developments where I actually invested most of the money. So I figured I should have a place in there and figure out what was going on. That was like I'm on the advisory board and I'm reading this document that I barely understand. But it was a learning process. And then when I knew my career was coming to an end, again, we were fortunate to live in a very, very good community. Yeah, obviously, people have had a lot of success. They had good jobs, also very family driven. So you're sitting around and having a barbecue in the summertime with your neighbors. And they're Microsoft executives or Boeing executives. Or we're sitting at tea league games or basketball games with our kids. We sit in the bleachers and you get to know your kids' parents and your kids' friends' parents, I should say. And I ended up having lots of good friends that way and neighbors. And we're like, hey, you're getting kind of old. Well, you know, basketball's going to be over soon. What are you doing next? And it was just literally just brainstorming of, you know, what do I bring to a table? Because, you know, I went to college 16 years ago and it didn't matter. I could have studied anything and it didn't really matter anymore 16 years later. So did I want to start from scratch? And I was basically just trying to figure out what I do have. And it was which great connections, pretty good reputation, and a name to get my foot in the door. And that's how I started out being a partner in a venture fund and learning the business on the fly, knowing what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. And that's really how I started the process of getting into the business world.
What were some of the questions you would ask people if it was just talking to a friend at a barbecue and they were starting to think in this way about what's next? Or what were some of the questions that allowed you to get focused on, you know, where you might go?
Yeah, definitely. I think there is some background question around what's your education, what are you interested in, what's your passion? And I didn't really have much of that. My education was a long time ago. My interest, you know, if you had told me back then, would you rather invest money in some business and supervise it and raise more money for it? Or if you rather, you know, take a hammer and shovel and do it yourself and build something, I would probably have chosen the latter, said, you know, I think I'm better at putting something together with my hands than actually doing the other thing. But we basically talked about what do I have? What does my life look like as far as connections? And you're sitting there with a Microsoft executive and a Boeing executive or some startup guy, and they kind of go, all of us, you know. And through playing basketball over the years, I've met just about any CEO in the country. My first 10 years, I was totally ignorant to that. You could have come up to me and said, here is the CEO of Nike or Adidas or whatever. Adidas might have been different because that was what I was wearing. But any large company, Target, and I would have just said, hey, good to see you, and turned around and would have not remembered that name because it was absolutely no interest to me because I just had shutters on. It was all about basketball. I think then when you get older, you realize it could be over any day. And you realize maybe I should figure out what I want to do next. But also, I started doing all this charitable work, and I was pitching C-level executives to, you know, sponsor our foundation, buy a table at our auction, buy a foursome for the golf tournament. So I got to know basically everyone in Seattle over that time period. So they were going, you got an incredible network, not just regionally, but nationally, some even internationally. So there's a way to, you can open doors, you can probably raise money, you can get people together for something. And that's how we started out. And then one of the guys I'm sitting around with, he's like, I'm thinking about leaving Microsoft. Why don't we start a venture fund? I'm going, how? That's literally how it started. I was just fortunate and dumb enough to stumble into all these things.
It sounds like some of the forces converge there too, with things you were learning from philanthropy and then connections from the MBA and your kind of personal network, and things sort of organically came together in some ways, or there's some overlap from the conversations and the lessons. I'd love to just ask you, in that transition from being very focused and having the shutters on with basketball to then going to your next thing, what came into focus in terms of figuring out what mattered to you or what your values or principles were that were going to be most important?
Yeah, to me, it's I try to live a pretty simple life as far as how I go about it. I think if you define your values as a family, I think it's pretty darn simple. You try to be a good father and husband and family man, be good to your friends, have compassion, and all those things that sound really corny when you're young. Respect your elders, treat everyone the way you want to be treated. All those really basic common sense things that seems like nobody has anymore. And that's really what I try to live by. I treat a CEO just like I treat a waitress at a restaurant. And I would probably say I try to treat them better. And I try to have compassion, be kind to people. And I really don't have time for people that are not that way. I don't care if there could be huge potential prospects or a great relationship. Or a friend that all of a sudden you realize they're not really that kind. My time has run out. I don't have time for it anymore. But you learn those things along the way. And that's how I approach everything in life. And to me, that's a good way to enter the charitable world. And it's also a good way to enter business because it builds a lot of trust.
Yeah, it's funny that you say the common sense things. It reminds me of wisdom that my grandparents probably been giving me over the years, and I was like not listening.
Yeah, definitely. Same.
I wanted to ask you about books briefly. I heard in a different interview that you, in your playing days, you were, you know, often reading on the airplane when other guys were sleeping. And I'm curious, like, the role that reading has played in your life and just how you think and how you operate.
Yeah, definitely. As a pro athlete, especially a basketball player, you travel so much. You're on planes, you're in buses, you sit in hotel lobbies. Yeah, you're very busy. You practice and you play games, but there's a lot of downtime. And where you're not in the gym, we're not in the weight room, we're not watching film. And to me, it's probably a good thing that Xbox and that stuff came out a little later in my career. But I never got into playing video games. I remember we bought, I think it was in Dallas, first thing, I wanted something. We went somewhere, they gave us like those original ping pong video games, which is just, you know, ridiculous. Ping pong. I was just like, and we played that, like my wife and I, for hours, because it was two of us at night. We'd go to bed at 2 a.m. and we'd be doing the stump ping pong thing. But then it got really busy, and then we had kids, and then all that was over. We were watching Barney and things like that with them. So I never got into that, which is probably good. Also, I never was much of a gambler. So when guys were playing cards on the plane, I would occasionally join them when the stakes were going up to the 3 digits and beyond. I was like, this is dumb. Oh, yeah, I'm not a good player, and I'm going to lose this money here for what? For what reason? And I truly enjoyed reading. So I don't know why, because in school I hated it. But when you have downtime, I read everything from biographies to I would get into series. And some were just basically just time killers. So you get into a series of like a serial killer, you know, multiple books in a row. Yeah. Or I used to love the Tom Clancy books. I literally read every single Tom Clancy book because I love the technical aspect of it and how he described everything. And then you, later on, you get a little bit more aware, and people saying you should read this book or that book. Like right now, I'm reading The Color of Law. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's basically about all the decisions like Supreme Court and Supreme Justices have made in the last 100 years, and how that has really depressed people of color for so long. You know, it's an eye opener, right? So every day to me is a learning experience. And I must say, I don't read as much as I used to, because my day is filled with reading and reading emails, replying to emails, reading documents. And sometimes I sit that night and my wife goes, "Why don't you read?" And I go, "You know what? I'm just tired of reading. I'd rather watch a really stupid show." But I think reading is a very important part of who I am and what made me.
Yeah. Any books that you often recommend, or books that had a big influence on you over the years?
That's a good question, because I spoke at a startup event last year, and a few guys asked me that, and I was like sitting there going, I'll have to go back and look at my library. And then I realized that we gave away like 3,000 books, because we don't have shelves anymore, and nobody reads books. We put them on, we download them now. No, I think the biographies are quite amazing. And just saw a statement yesterday, you know, if you don't believe, for example, or you're not sure about what Hitler was, read any books about that, because I grew up in that country. And when people put serious doubt on what the history of it was, I said, just educate yourself about Hitler, Mussolini, all those dictators over the years. Educate yourself about the history of the United States, and not just what you were told in U.S. history, but about the true history. And I've learned stuff that I couldn't even find it before. Nobody was writing about it or talking about it, like Black Wall Street or Juneteenth. So things like that, where this is, every country has dark history, and you got to face it. So educate yourself, because it's a shame that we are, as the world's greatest nation, are the least educated developed nation in the world. So read anything, read a book.
Yeah. I love the way you're saying that. If you have some question about what's the truth and what happened in the past, go read history, read biographies. It's all out there.
Yeah. And it's documented. It's actually facts.
Yeah. 3,000 books is an incredible amount. Must have taken some time to give all that away too and switch to digital. I want to, before we wrap up with the rapid fire round, I wanted to ask you about Erase the Hate. I saw there was maybe a backstory that t-shirt and slogan had been around, and you've been pretty active about raising money for this project. Can you tell the story about that?
Yeah, definitely. When most people became aware is after George Floyd got murdered. Obviously, that has happened and is still happening in our country. But most people became aware of it because of the activism that followed it, the protests and so forth. It took me a little while to figure out, without a foundation, how I can have an impact. It's definitely stuff I've seen for many years, stuff I have supported to fight against for many years, but I was not very active in it. And I figured this is a time you can't just sit by. You have to take a leading role. And again, on my side, it's a little tough to take a leading role when you're older and white, so I can't really be the face or the voice, but I can relate. I'm married to a Black woman. I have two biracial sons, and we've had those talks over the years. And so I can relate. And my point was, I need a little bit more than my following, or I got to go outside the circles of our community and try to amplify my message. So I talked first with Jamal Crawford, and then had other conversations. So some people joined me in launching Erase the Hate. And we came up with Erase the Hate, or I came up with Erase the Hate, because back during the LA riots in the early 90s, our babysitter came up with the logo, and we had t-shirts. We've had t-shirts since the 90s with us, which is a sad thing, because we're still talking about the same thing. So we called our campaign, our cause, Erase the Hate. And with Jamal Crawford, Isaiah Thomas, Bill Russell, Macklemore, Jimmy Lake, Pat Monahan, Alicia Clark from The Storm, I launched this. And we ended up, I think we're still going to have $10,000 to match. So we're matching whatever people are giving to the causes, and which is all causes that are fighting for racial justice, equality, equity, inclusion, diversity, really what we are supposed to be all about. And and that's what we're doing. We continue this fight. And after what you saw last week, we got a long ways to go.
Absolutely. And where can people go if they want to support that or learn more? What's the best place to find out?
Yeah, definitely. So the Cause app is a new giving app that where I've transitioned my foundation to, my money to. So all my giving is done through this Cause app, and it's CAUZE.com. And my campaign, my cause is called Erase the Hate. And
so just go search for it in the app.
Yeah.
So search Erase the Hate. Okay, great. I'll put a link in the show notes as well for people. Yeah.
And also, can also go to detlef.com, which used to be our foundation site where we are selling gear. So we're selling the masks and t-shirts, Erase the Hate with the logo on it. There are also links to the Cause app. And at the same time, I'm also doing cameo appearances for the cause. So I do cameos and all the money goes to our cause to raise more money. I'm trying to just do different things to basically engage more people and amplify our message and amplify our giving.
Perfect. I love it. All right. I want to wrap up with the supersonic six, which is what I call the rapid fire round. And so number one, how much coffee do you drink?
I get up early. I drink a couple cups in the morning before I get going, do emails. Very seldom one in the afternoon. Typically when I have a coffee meeting, I'll probably have one cup in the afternoon.
All right. Number two, what's one Seattle company that you're following right now?
Which company am I not following?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot going on.
It's got a lot going on in biopharma, biotech, obviously with all the large companies, Amazon and so forth. But people probably don't realize that Seattle is a strong community for gaming, and Valve software is just, they're killing it. So that's one company I definitely follow.
Great one. Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Lots of them. I think we have just a great base of people that are outspoken, that are community engaged. My links to that is typically like a John Cook from GeekWire, because anything in the tech world, he brings out, him and Jonathan Sposato, they bring out to the forefront. So it's one click away if I'm interested in something or what someone is doing. Definitely those people. I'd say I'd follow Bill Gates a little bit, but he's obviously not someone I can call up and ask for advice on, but a lot of other people I can.
Number four, what's one thing Seattle needs to improve as a tech hub?
I think Seattle is there as far as one of the best in the country. I guess you could argue it's one of the best three, but it does not have the funding. We talk about Silicon Valley, VC firms, the money that goes to work. Seattle has definitely lagged behind in the years, but it has stepped up the last year and a half, and I think it's getting to that point where there's more money being raised, there's more money being put to work in our community and not leaving the state like it used to.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Oh boy. Lots of advice. I'd say the first one in anything, take a deep breath and wait 5 seconds. When you're young, and obviously I had a temper, there's a lot of times where I go, oh, should have taken that breath, and or making a decision or having a reply to a conversation. It's like nowadays, because you're not really directly in front of people a lot of times, you're reacting towards an email or a post, and you write that reply and then you go, hold on a second, let me walk away and get a cup of coffee and think about it. And then you come back and you go, oh, I can't do that. I can't post that. I can't write that. And no, that's not really what I mean. Or that's coming across very negatively. So yeah, as a 20-year-old, I had a hot temper. So definitely take a breath and wait 5-10 seconds before you think about it.
Number six, the last one. What would you like listeners to do or check out? We talked about Erase the Hate, but anything you would like people to go do or pay attention to, or any action you'd like folks to take?
Yeah, and nowadays in our world, and people not being out as much, and they're on their device all day. And if you don't believe you're being, not spammed, but you're being sent information that you typically first read, right? And people don't want to believe this, but if I like a BMW over a Volvo, and I look at BMW 10 times a day, I'm going to get those ads. I'm going to get that communication. It's going to be in my Twitter feed. It's going to be in my Facebook feed. I'm going to have all this information sent my way. So you basically, whatever your beliefs are and whatever you keep reading and seeing and watching, it's going to be reemphasized by where you go and what you do. I urge people to branch out, look at some other news outlets, read some other facts, talk to some other people, really dig down and find facts if something that, you know, believe is true, if it's true. Because nowadays, it's really hard to understand what is true and what isn't anymore, because when leading people in your community point you in one way, a lot of people will just follow.
I love that. And it goes back to what you were saying about books and seeking the truth and learning from history, which awesome lesson. This is awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate you. Super inspiring.
Okay. Awesome, Adam. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.